From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Julie Farnham returns to the show this week. She's the author of a book you must read called Domestic Darkness, an insider's account of the January 6th insurrection and the future of right-wing extremism. Julie Farnham was assistant director of intelligence for the United States Capitol Police during the January 6, 2021 insurrection, which happened, by the way. She served with the Department of Homeland Security for over 15 years, and she is a recognized expert in intelligence and immigration. Julie Farnham, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
It's very nice to see you. Yeah, and because the news changes hourly, I think I will tell our listeners that we are talking on Tuesday, June 24th. I'm not really sure where to begin, but let's start with this. President Trump pardoned all the Capitol rioters since we spoke last, and I wondered what your thoughts were when that happened.
It's such, it's disappointing. It's so frustrating because we have a president who on one hand claims that he is for law and order, but then pardons people who assaulted police officers and who compromised our democracy. And so that's very, very frustrating. We've seen him pardon quite a few people, not just the January 6th insurrectionists. And it seems like he will pardon if he thinks that he has something to gain for it. So some of the other people that he's pardoned have made large donations to him. I think he thinks that pardoning the January 6th insurrectionists that gave him a lot of political clout. And those were his supporters. Those were his people. And to thank them for voting for him, he pardoned them.
It doesn't seem like anything will ever backfire on him because nothing so far ever has. But it seemed to me that that could backfire because, I mean, well, I didn't like what he's doing anyway. But still, the people that he pardoned were people who committed crimes, terrible crimes.
Absolutely. And, you know, some of them have gone on to commit other crimes and some of them are back in prison now. I think, you know, there's a real opportunity for states to press charges because a lot of those criminal acts happened outside of Washington, D.C., with, you know, the planning and weapons and things like that. And, you know, some states don't have statute of limitations for felonies committed within their states. So I think there is an opportunity for states to do something with those who were pardoned, but whether or not they will, because, you know, it's an uphill battle, right? Not only do you have to press charges, but presumably that requires some cooperation from the Department of Justice. And we know that's not going to happen. Or getting grand jury testimony unsealed is very, very difficult. So, you know, whether or not that can happen, you know, that's yet to be seen, but there is an opportunity there for states to do something if the federal government will not.
Well, before the election last year, you were here with us and you were warning us about the dangers of a second Trump presidency. And so it's here. we're your, no, I don't understand people, all the millions of people who listened to this program and voted for him anyway. That's nuts. But were your fears justified?
Yeah, I mean, I think where we are right now, it's very problematic. There's a lot of things that the Trump administration has done and is continuing to do that I think make us weak as a country. And right now is not the time to be weak. And so I just put something up on Substack earlier today about three things that I think are really point to us being at one of our weakest moments as a country. One is the assault on federal workers. You know, I worked in the federal government for almost 20 years, and to see this like slash and burn, like dismissal of good federal employees, employees who really just wanted to positively contribute and serve our country. That wasn't, and it's not to say that the government couldn't be more efficient. I don't think anyone's arguing that. There are certainly areas for improvement, but the way it was done, you know, it does a lot to foster, resentment. And I think that makes a lot, and these are employees who many of them know like secrets. They know a lot of sensitive information. They're without a job now. They're, especially in a place, you know, I'm in Arlington, Virginia, where we have a very large concentration of federal employees. And now they have no job. They're flooding the job market. And, you know, it's going to be hard for them or a lot of them to find jobs. That makes them very vulnerable for compromise. And, you know, our adversaries are watching, and no doubt that some of those former federal employees will be recruited. Mm. And we saw that, you know, someone from the DIA was arrested 2 weeks ago from Alexandria, Virginia, which borders Arlington. And he said, you know, he didn't agree with what the Trump administration was doing. And so, you know, what Trump is doing is really fostering this like resentment, and there are a lot of angry people, and our adversaries are going to capitalize on that. And then I think, oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you're going to ask a question. No, you keep going.
So, and then the other part is, you know, we have national security leaders who have questionable integrity, questionable experience. We have, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, who met with Assad, was one of the most ruthless dictators we've had in modern times. And didn't just like, you know, to go to Syria is one thing, and to like meet with the leader for hours on end, and then to get nominated to be the director of national intelligence is just crazy. You know, and then she also refused to say that Edward Snowden was a traitor, even though he was responsible for one of the largest leaks of intelligence in U.S. history. Those are all very, very problematic actions. And now she's in charge of intelligence here in the United States. And then we have Thomas Fugate, the 22-year-old who was just appointed at Department of Homeland Security. Like, this does not make us safer. This does not make us safer. And then I think the last big thing that the Trump administration has been doing that makes us weaker is politicizing the military. That's, you know, we have the parade, but that's just the latest in like a long string of things that Trump has done in the first 6 months of his administration. He dismissed, you know, top JAGs. He's dismissed four-star generals. He has renamed bases. A lot of things that make the military political. And I think one of our strengths is that our military was generally apolitical.
Well, there are many things that were precedent in the past that President Trump has negated or violated. For instance, saying bad things about your predecessor. That's something that he says all the time. I heard him use the F word today on the White House lawn, which, I mean, I know there's a lot of expletive deleted in President Nixon's transcripts, but he never said them on the radio. You would think that the director of intelligence should in fact have some intelligence if they're the director of intelligence. So the cronyism, I guess you would call it, of bringing in people. I mean, there was also kind of an institutional memory in the past. I mean, even when I think there have been cases when a new party would take office and yet keep the same attorney general, or, you know, they would keep people in their positions. Certainly the FBI director was director of the FBI for decades over many presidents.
Right, absolutely. And I think, you know, the other big thing that is highly problematic is the lack of due process that we're seeing when it comes to immigration, when it comes to, you know, other instances as well. That is, right now it's immigrants that are targeted, but if we erode, you know, our constitution and our due process rights, that's eventually going to hit Americans as well. And I don't know if people fully appreciate that or realize that, but this is dangerous.
Do you feel that that's happening? I mean, do you feel that he's starting with immigrants because he wants to erode the rights of other Americans?
Yes and no. Like, I can see him wanting to erode the rights of people that he perceives as opposition, people who are going to get in his way, people who don't subscribe to his ideology, you know, people that he considers enemies, even internal enemies. And, you know, it starts with immigrants. And it's interesting because, you know, immigrants I understand that was one of his key points as he was campaigning, and that resonated with a lot of people. And certainly, I think Biden did not do a great job when it came to the border and to immigration generally, and Trump capitalized on that opportunity to the extreme. But now we have, you know, individuals who are getting removed, getting deported without having hearings, getting deported to third countries, which is crazy. Can you imagine, like, getting deported and then you're in El Salvador, you're in Rwanda, like, where you have no connection to those places.
And is he doing that as a deterrent to, what is the official purpose of deporting people to third countries?
I think he would say to deter people from coming here, and also cleaning up the people who are here, you know, without papers, without a lawful means to be here. But at the same time, he's instilling a lot of fear, and it will ultimately result in an economic impact. You know, we have these immigrants working in our hotels, working in our restaurants, working on our farms. You know, if people went crazy over egg prices during the campaign because of inflation, like, how much do you think those eggs are going to cost if no one's there to collect them on the farms? It's going to be expensive. Like, so I don't think people are fully appreciating the impact that this will have long term.
Well, I know that you worked for Homeland Security for a long time, and that you are an expert on immigration. And you told me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you said that you didn't think there was a crisis in immigration. This was before the election. Is there a crisis in immigration, and is there one now? And what is your stand on immigration today?
There might be a crisis now, or not, I think, in the way you originally meant your question. I don't think it was as big of a crisis as Trump made it out to be. Should the border have been more secure? Yes. Should we have reform in our asylum? Yes. Like, should we do something long term to address the people who are here unlawfully? Yes. Like, all of those things. But to the point where, you know, I think Trump frames it like they're criminals and they're hurting our country. I don't think that was the case. You know, are there criminal immigrants? Sure, there are, but there are more American-born criminals than there are immigrant criminals. So you just need to put it all in context. But as far as it goes now, you know, I do have, like, normally when someone is referred to ICE or turned over to ICE because they're not here lawfully or their benefit requests were denied, you know, they go, they have at least two hearings before an immigration judge. One is the master hearing, which is sort of like an arraignment. And then you have an individual hearing where the immigration judge hears the merits of your case and decides if you need to go or if you can stay. And it seems like a lot of that, there are means for expedited removal, but they're pretty limited in the law. And I think Trump, at least from what I'm seeing, is kind of expanding that definition. So I do think that will be challenged in court eventually. And the other thing with ICE, and I used to work for Homeland Security Investigations, which is part of ICE, you know, ICE would prioritize the most dangerous of criminals. And that's because there weren't enough resources. And also, it can take years for someone to get an immigration hearing, especially in certain courts that are quite busy. And so if they're not expanding the number of courts, then it's still in there. And unless they, you know, erode those due process rights, it's going to take years for people to have a hearing and then be removed properly. So he's creating a lot more problems when it comes to immigration than he is solving them.
But if it takes so long, then why not just send them to Sudan now and worry about them when their day in court comes?
Well, because people deserve their time in court and deserve to have the merits of their case heard. And, you know, that's the same goes for, you know, a criminal case with Americans. Like, you're accused of something, and in the immigration context, it's administrative. It's not, you know, civil or criminal court. But, you know, they're being accused of not being here lawfully. And immigration law is really complex, very, very complex. And there is a lot of gray areas. There's a lot of opportunities to stay. There are, you know, probably equal opportunities to be removed too, but it depends on, you know, how you apply it and how, you know, the specifics of your case. And so those people have a right to have their case heard.
Is a birthright citizenship one of those gray areas of immigration?
I would say no. I think the administration would say yes. I do have an article on my website, which is jfarnum.com, about birthright citizenship and kind of just like a primer on like what it is and the exceptions to it and who's allowed to stay, who's not allowed to stay. The most common exception is people who are born to parents in diplomatic status because they're not subject to the laws of the United States. And we see that a lot. We see that a lot, particularly here in the DC area. But Trump is saying that, you know, that definition of who is not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States is much broader than how it has traditionally been interpreted. I know the Supreme Court will ultimately decide that, but I just don't see that being overturned.
The Supreme Court, you mentioned. So, I mean, all of the things that go to court can eventually end up at the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has been stacked, I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
So, I mean, Trump has a certain amount of confidence that when he shoots a man on Fifth Avenue, as he said he could, that the Supreme Court would say that you can't prosecute a president for anything, no matter what he does.
I don't know. I mean, certainly the court is conservative and they've made some very, very conservative decisions, like, you know, the overturning Roe v. Wade. But at the same time, the court has not systematically agreed with Trump, and they do not always rule in favor of Trump. And he's seeing that, Trump is seeing that across the board at all levels of court, including judges that he appointed. And that's a source of, I think, great frustration to him. So we'll see how it goes. I think we'll see how it goes, but I would not automatically assume that the current Supreme Court will just rubber stamp whatever Trump wants.
Do you think that foreign students coming here to study at, say, Harvard pose a threat to the United States in any way?
Not more so than any other students. You know, I think what the thing with the foreign students, and before I worked for the government, I was the student advisor at Emerson College. So I did all the foreign student visa stuff at a university in Boston. And so with foreign students, what I think people, and maybe Trump himself, does not fully realize is that they're not getting student loans for the most part. They're not getting, they might get scholarships, but they are generally paying like upfront for their college education, which most American students do not. They take out student loans and what have you. So they're an incredible source of income for these universities. And for Trump to pull that back, you know, that's going to financially hurt a lot of universities. You know, Harvard's going to be okay. But some of these smaller universities that really depend on the income that comes with foreign students, they're going to hurt. And that's going to be really problematic. I mean, I think the perception is that universities generally are, you know, these liberal like pools. And so I think that is part of what fuels Trump's assaults on universities, whether it be with student visas or, you know, cutting some of the grants and the funding that these universities get. But we need to have educated people. And I think these universities do more to advance our country than to hinder it.
Now, this is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're talking with Julie Farnum, and her most recent book is called Domestic Darkness, An Insider's Account of the January 6th Insurrection and the Future of Right-Wing Extremism. Well, having an educated population of people who are well-educated, they always know when people are lying to them if they're well-read. And so it would make sense that the Trump administration is anti-administration. I mean, I'm not being facetious, really. I think that the Republican, the extreme wing of the Republican Party, that minority that is in charge right now, doesn't like education and wants people to be undereducated.
Well, people can be manipulated a lot more easily if they don't have those critical thinking skills. And it's not to say, it's not so much like formal education. There are a lot of very intelligent people who don't have degrees, but to have those like critical thinking skills and to be able to question what's being told to you, it behooves Trump and his administration to not have people with those skills.
Tell me, Julie Farnham, what is your current, what is it that you have? You have an agency. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I do own my own business. I do private investigations, investigative intelligence.
And you're also you write, I guess you're a ghostwriter. You write speeches for politicians. Is that?
Speeches, op-eds, those sorts of things. Yes, I do quite a bit of ghostwriting.
Yeah. And is that frustrating to not put your own name on the things that you're saying, or do you feel like you're contributing in a positive way?
No, like I don't take like personal ownership over the things that I'm hired to write for others. Yeah. But I do appreciate having the opportunity to express, you know, what they're trying to communicate in a way that hopefully people, it resonates with people and that they understand and the message gets across. So I think that's fulfilling for me for sure. And, you know, there's always editing and feedback and things like that. And you think, well, I wouldn't really say it that way, but you're not writing it for you.
You have to let go of it. Yeah. Uh-huh. That must be an art form. You told me that you wrote the Pete Buttigieg's position on immigration. Is it an ongoing changing opinion that you have, or are you the things that are true and that's how it is?
I think as far as my immigration and the policy I helped when Pete Buttigieg was running for office or running for president, I think it was a really good policy and it outlined a long-term plan. Because what happened is just some background, you know, in the 1980s, Reagan signed into law an immigration law that had created quote unquote amnesty. And that took a bunch of people who were here unlawfully and made them legal. There were like agricultural workers. There were other employees or working immigrants who were able to become legal, get a green card, get temporary status, and then get a green card and then eventually become citizens. There was a lot of fraud in the program for a lot of different reasons. And so here we are, fast forward, you know, 40 years, and we're in the same position. So if we don't have an immigration system and an immigration plan to address it long term, like, okay, we can, Congress presumably could pass a law that legalized, you know, the 11 million or so people who are here unlawfully. But then 40 years from now, we're going to have the same problem again. So we need to come up with a better system. And that does need to be combined with better enforcement and clearer priorities for enforcement. Certainly the border needs to be secured or secured better than it has been. And we do need real reform in our asylum process. So that's it.
A wall is a good idea or a bad idea?
I don't think the wall is a good idea. And I sat in on those meetings during Trump's first administration talking about building the wall. The wall was never going to get built. And actually, Bush, the second Bush, and Clinton and Obama all built more wall than Trump did. Oh. So as much as he likes to boast about his wall, he didn't build a whole lot of wall. Yeah. He repaired a lot of wall, but not built more wall. It was never going to work because a lot of that land along the border is privately owned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they're Trump supporters, I would guess that a lot of people in like Texas and Arizona, those places are Trump supporters. And it's not going to look good if the government comes in and takes your land to build a wall. So the wall was never going to happen. And as Janet Napolitano used to say, she's like, if you show me an 11-foot wall, I'll show you a 12-foot ladder. So yes. you need to think differently. How do you prevent people from wanting to come here in the first place? And, you know, I think that's a combination of addressing some of the drivers for migration, but also making it clear that once you get here, you're not going to be able to stay. And that's why I think border security pairs so closely with asylum reform.
So You haven't given up. I mean, you're young and you have young children, but you haven't, you know, like Trump won and you didn't move to some obscure book, Canada or Greenland or someplace.
maybe not Greenland, but. Yeah.
So do you still have hope? I mean, what can we do?
I do have hope. I'm not ready to throw in the towel just yet on the United States. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the midterms. I think the Democrats are going to do well, although the Democrats, they have their own sort of issues that need to be addressed that I don't think they're adequately addressing right now. But, you know, I think there is hope. I think over the next 2 to 4 years, what happens then will be very telling on what our future will be. Is we have to think about, like, who comes behind Trump? Because Trump is old. Like, Trump is old. As much as I think he would want a third term, I just don't think he's young enough to push for that. So who comes in behind him? And is it going to be the same sort of, you know, MAGA ideology? But we'll see what happens.
Well, I don't see a lot. I mean, there's not a lot of Democratic leadership. I don't see a lot of Democratic leadership. I don't hear them every day. I think they should be speaking out every single day. And if they are, how come I don't hear them?
Right, exactly. And, you know, Democrats have traditionally been pretty awful at communicating. They don't like to tout their successes. They're not great about it. They're not great at pouncing on, you know, the other side and what they're doing wrong. Like Republicans or MAGA Republicans, I won't say Republicans generally, but yes. MAGA Republicans, they'll be all over any misstep instantly. The Democrats have also not been great at embracing, you know, new media, like social media and things like that. The Republicans were definitely ahead of the Democrats on that front. And I think the Democrats still lag on engaging people. They spend a lot of money on traditional media and like no one's watching TV anymore. So like they need to change the way they communicate.
One of my friends gets angry because he donated money. And now they won't stop texting him. And it makes him feel like he's never going to give money ever again. And I kind of understand where he's coming from. I mean, I don't think that, I mean, why don't we hear every single day from Democrats? I mean, Pete Buttigieg, for instance, we hear from him occasionally. But, do you think that openly gay person has a chance of becoming president of the United States? Who out there, what Democrats out there could be president?
I think the lineup in 3.5 years is going to be Buttigieg. I think it's going to be Newsom. I think it's going to be Whitmer. And I think it's going to be Rahm Emanuel. Those are going to be the four that I think are going to run. And I think any one of them would have a good chance at winning. All of them have their pros and cons and their baggage. But I think all of them would be good. Like I'd be happy to vote for any of them. So we'll see what happens.
Of course, you and I are willing to vote, but I mean, yes. I think if we look at the record of Trump in the elections, he ran 3 times and he won twice. And both times the person he was running against was a woman. So it seems like America is not ready for a woman president.
Yeah, I would unfortunately agree with that. You know, but we said that about Obama, too, that we weren't ready for a black president. And then he was elected and he was a very good president. So we'll see what happens. Eventually, a woman will be president. We are way far behind other countries when it comes to female leadership and female representation generally. I think in Congress right now, women only make up about 27%. So there is a huge gender gap in our politics that needs to be closed. And I think if we start closing that gap on like down ballot, whether it be Congress or state and local races, that will help. Because that will be the stepping stone for eventually there will be a woman who will step forward and will get elected.
Well, there was, African-American men could vote before women could.
Right. So
a long time.
It's coming. Yeah. The day is coming. Just I don't know when.
So what other than the Democrats coming out and doing more, which they're not doing, what can people like me, you and me do?
I think it starts just by getting involved. Like, democracy only works when people participate. And if people don't participate, then we don't have a democracy anymore. So I think that's first and foremost. And I went to a thing at the DNC maybe a month or so ago, and Ken Martin was speaking. And I really, his vision for the Democratic Party really resonated with me. And he talked a lot about, and you touched upon this earlier, when we're trying to get people involved, it can't be just about like give money. It needs to get people involved, like volunteering. And, you know, volunteering can be something small, something where you don't have to interact with people, as someone who's like kind of introverted like me. Yes. You know, interacting with people is not always, you know, my first choice, but you can do things like write postcards. You can do things like make phone calls. And that is not as awful as it sounds. People are generally pretty nice. And you can get out there. You can be a poll greeter. You can go knock on doors. You can ghostwrite for candidates. You know, there is a whole host of things that you can do to get involved that do not involve giving money, but also help advance candidates and politicians that you believe in and you think whose values align with yours.
Well, I know that you recently ran for office. We talked about this after you ran and lost. You said, well, that's it. I'm never going to do that again. And I wonder now that a few months have gone by, have you changed your mind? I mean, do you think you might run again and get involved in politics on that level again?
I don't know. You know, I did this program at American University called We Lead Women in Politics. And it's exactly, you know, what it says to close the gender gap in politics, like we just spoke about. And I went back maybe 2 months ago to talk to the new class. And I was like, you want me to come talk to them? I was like, I'm a loser. And they're like, no, we want you to tell them what it was really like campaigning and stuff. Yeah. So I went and talked to them. And the program coordinator, she said, you know, well, the person who won, how many times did he run? And I said, I think he ran 4 times. She's like, and he lost all those other times. And I was like, yes. And she's like, mm-hmm.
Right, that's right.
In other words, yeah, don't expect to win on the first try. So I don't know, like Arlington, actually, I'm writing another book and the book is about my run and it is about the larger issues within the Democratic Party.
That was my idea that you write that book. I want to get acknowledgement.
Yes, I will make sure you are acknowledged.
Good.
I think Arlington's a place in transition politically too. You know, it is traditionally a very liberal place, very, very liberal. And I think that's part of the reason why I lost is because I'm more moderate. I'd like to say I'm more reasonable. They would argue with that. They would say maybe less progressive, but more moderate, more just left of center. And there's going to be a revolt in Arlington. I think we're starting to see a little bit of it. What was very telling is that just 20 days ago on June 4th, the Democratic Party in Arlington proposed changes to their bylaws, which is a very like boring thing to talk about. But what was interesting with this is that the change was going to be how or who could vote for party leadership. So the chairman, all the officer positions. And right now, any registered Democratic voter can vote for the party leadership. But they want to change it so that only people who are party committee members, of which there are 191 people right now, only those 191 people are eligible to vote for officers. There are 132,000 registered Democrats in Arlington. So they essentially want to take away, you know, over 130,000 people from being able to vote for their leadership. And I think they're doing it because they fear that there's a revolt and that people who are more moderate are going to get in and start leading the party. And that's going to change the dynamics of the party. That's going to change, you know, the priorities of the party. And people are scared. I mean, I guess that's true for anyone in a position of power. Like you can maintain it or you can lose it. And to maintain it, you do crazy things like change the bylaws. So I think that's really, really problematic. But I think it speaks to some pressure that the Democratic Party in Arlington and beyond is feeling because they've gotten so far left.
So, but the Republican Party in the rest of the world, in the rest of the country, they fear the erosion of their leadership. And so they are doing whatever they can to limit the voting rights of other people. I mean, it goes both ways, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You've heard, I'm sure, you know, the woke right and then the blue right. MAGA. They're kind of like two sides of the same coin. They take the same tactics. They're doing it for different reasons. But it's the same tactics, and it's done to preserve power and to restrict rights. And we see it on both sides.
Right. The whole woke thing, the right feels that, being aware of a person's race or gender is giving them a leg up or something. I don't know what is it against. What is the anti-woke thing all about?
I don't know. It's just like it's completely nonsensical. Like it's rooted in racism. It's rooted in, you know, this great replacement that, you know, people in power, particularly white people in power, are somehow going to lose their power if it's not a pie. Like, we can all be empowered. And it's just very, very frustrating to see, like, this assault on DEI and and assault on women, assault on people of color. Like, it's so frustrating. Like, I don't understand why it's so threatening to some people if we have equal rights. Like, that just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, because you don't want men competing on a girls' soccer team.
Well, especially if the girls are better players.
In recent days, the United States has bombed Iran, and I wonder if you have some thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's so complex. Like, I can't say one way or the other, like good or bad. It's so complex. I mean, because it all is tied up with Israel, and Israel has a whole host of things going on, you know, and then Iran. I don't think anyone's arguing that Iran is like they're good or we shouldn't be bombing them. Like they're bad guys. They are not good. They've been fighting proxy wars in the Middle East and in Northern Africa for a long time. They are well versed in fighting. They are a threat, I think, to the world, not just Israel, not just the United States. They're a threat to a lot of countries and a lot of places. So, like, Iran, in bombing Iran, like, that's one thing, but, like, the reasons behind it. And I don't think Americans fully appreciate, like, what a bad leader Netanyahu is. Like, he's not a good person. And that's not to say anything of, like, you know, the people of Israel are good people, but Netanyahu is not representing them well. And in a lot of ways, and this is going to be controversial when I say this, like, Netanyahu has his power because of Hamas. Like, you know, Hamas they've served as a distraction, allowing Netanyahu to stay in power for a lot longer than I think he would have otherwise.
In the way that, say, President Roosevelt was president for 12 years because World War II was happening?
Right, right. I mean, Roosevelt and Netanyahu, I think, are a different character. But, you know, the same thing, right? You know, you've got this war, you've got this individual who's in power. He's done a lot of extreme things in Israel that I think have eroded the rights of Israelis. And this war with Gaza has allowed him to remain in power and to avoid potentially conviction. I mean, he was indicted in, what, 2019, 2020 for bribery and fraud and all sorts of, like, bad things. And he's avoided prosecution so far, so...
That sounds familiar.
Yes, I know. I don't think it's surprising at all that Trump is in his corner.
So did President Trump do a great and brave thing or an opportunistic thing? Or he just, I don't know. What is your assessment of Trump's actions?
I don't think they can be assessed yet. I think it will be telling what happens. You know, I know Iran bombed Qatar or sent missiles towards Qatar. Iran is very good at playing the long game. And we'll see what they do. And it may be a longer term battle than what I think Trump is willing to admit or understands. We'll see what happens. But, you know, Iran was pretty upset, is still pretty upset over the assassination of Soleimani. And they still talk about avenging his death all the time. So, you know, like, if they're still upset over something that happened, you know, 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago, you know, they're not going to forget this either.
President Nixon once said that President Roosevelt, for instance, that history gave him the opportunity to be great. complaining, I guess, that he didn't have those same opportunities historically. Do you think that in that way that President Trump is creating historical opportunities to look great and presidential?
Maybe in his head he is thinking that. But then if you take his like whole presidency and what he like, first of all, January 6th right there will always be a stain on his legacy. And he can try to distance himself. He can try to erase it by pardoning everyone. But I think long term truth is on the side of history's truth is on the side of history. And people will look back at his presidency. And that will be the number one thing that people remember. They're not going to remember that he bombed Iran, you know, sometime in June 2025. People are going to forget that. So if he wants to think about like being great, he needs to do more than this one action.
That may be, but do you think that people will remember it when the midterms come in a favorable way? That is, oh, you know, he's certainly done a lot. He even used the F word right on the...
No, not necessarily. And I will say, I say it because, you know, if you look at his previous term, his previous administration, like his successes were not what got people to the polls. His draw was promises of what he's going to do, you know, different, better, stronger, whatever it may be. It wasn't on his record. And so I don't necessarily think what he's doing now or what he has done in the past 6 months is what's going to drive people to vote for Republicans. It might drive people to vote for Democrats, but I don't see it having that same impact on Republicans.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground, but let me ask you to kind of summarize and tell me, what are the worst things that we should be worried about that President Trump has been doing since being elected, given that you told us before he was elected that it would be terrible?
The worst things, I do think, you know, the lack of due process rights that's probably for me like the number one thing. I think this systematic racism that we're seeing and making it okay to hate and to be racist, because you can sugarcoat it, you can call it whatever you want. But at the end of the day, if you are going after people who are not white, and not, you know, U.S. born individuals, you are fostering, you know, it's racism. And then you see like the assault on DEI and all of that. And those two things are very, very problematic. And I think the downsizing of the federal government, downsizing in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing. But when you're cutting programs, you know, and some of the grants and some of the research and things that were are things that make America great, and what make us leaders in, you know, the medical field and in the academic field and things like that. If you're cutting those programs, that's going to have a long-term impact on the ability for the United States to be great and remain great. And I don't think he fully appreciates that. So those would be my, I think, top three off the top of my head.
There was a killing and a shooting in Minnesota. of two lawmakers, and President Trump took the opportunity to say that the governor of Minnesota was a terrible governor. So it's not just people of color that he is assaulting. It is anyone who doesn't non-right-wing Americans.
Yeah, but I think that I agree with you. I'm not disagreeing with you. Yeah. But I think that is more speaks to the violence and the threats against politicians and political candidates, which we've seen a huge increase over, you know, the past 4 or 5 years. And like you said at the beginning of the program, you know, when I was with the Capitol Police, I investigated thousands, tens of thousands of threats against members of Congress. And we've just seen a huge increase. Actually, I did write something on Substack about that about a week or so ago, right after the shootings happened. Because, you know, people in Congress, they can get security. Not only 10 people in Congress have protective details, which became known when Scalise was shot a few years ago. But if there are significant threats, other members of Congress can get protective details too. And they have more resources and more that they can draw on to get protection and have security and do threat assessments and things like that. But local and state politicians don't, and also judges, for example, they don't have those same level of protection. And they're, I would say, probably out in the community a lot more than, you know, people in Congress. And that's a huge vulnerability. And when we foster all this rhetoric that we hear, particularly from the far right, that people think it's okay to commit violence. And a lot of people talk about violence, like almost all of the threats that I investigated when I was at the Capitol Police were done online. And, you know, talking about it and doing it, like it's not, it's, those are two different things. But if we talk about it enough, it makes it easier to make that jump from thinking to saying to doing.
That's scary. Do you have any thoughts about the role that the attempted assassination of President Trump had in his election?
I think it did energize the right. You know, I think they were always going to vote for him. Whether or not they made it to the polls is another thing. So I think it did help more than it hindered him.
There's a today is the primary, the Democratic primary in New York. And whoever wins that primary will most likely be mayor of New York. And so I wonder if you had any thoughts about that one.
That one's going to be really interesting. Cuomo comes with a lot of baggage. And then, you know, it'll just be very, very interesting to see how it goes. But I also think that it's interesting that those are the candidates, someone who's well-known and someone who's relatively new. And do New Yorkers want the devil they know, or do they want someone new? And so that's interesting. And I wish that the Democrats would put up stronger candidates. And not to say that that's no slight on either candidate in New York, but I think a lot of times in our elections, and this goes for Republicans too, but on both sides, it's not so much, you know, which candidate is the best. It's which one you like or you dislike least. So it's sort of like a pick your poison. Like they're both like, I don't love either one of them, so I'll go for this one. And that I think is a problem in our politics right now, is that we're not putting up the best candidates. And so that people are not as motivated to go to the polls unless they're being motivated by some sort of policy issue. They're not being motivated because they love the people who are running. And that, I think, is really problematic.
Well, what an uplifting conversation, Julie. tell me again about your new book. You're currently writing a book about your run in Arlington.
Yes.
And when will you finish it? And when will it be ready for me to read?
It probably won't be ready for like another year because those things take a while. But ideally, I'd like to have it out by the midterms.
And you have a Substack.
I do have a Substack called Firestarter Collective.
Oh, nice.
So, yes. And then a website, jfarnum.com.
Fantastic. Julie Farnham, it's always great to talk to you. Her book is called Domestic Darkness, An Insider's Account of the January 6th Insurrection and the Future of Right-Wing Extremism. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro.
Joining me now is Lissa Warren. She is the founder and president of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. And she's a professor at Emerson College in Boston, and she's active on Twitter at Lissa_Warren. And she joins me here occasionally on From the Bookshelf. Lissa Warren, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Gary. Good to be with you.
Lissa, what have you been reading?
I've been reading Play It Again, Sam, and the subtitle is Repetition in the Arts. It's by Samuel J. Kaiser. He is a theoretical linguist, and he was a professor at MIT for many years and even served as their associate provost for some time. Now, in his famous Norton lectures, Leonard Bernstein extolled repetition. He said that it gave poetry its musical qualities and that music theorists refused to take it seriously at their peril. In Play It Again, Sam, Samuel J. Kaiser's book, he seriously explores the way that repetition works in the sister arts of music, poetry, and painting. Now, this is not a book for the faint of heart. It's quite cerebral, but he makes really convincing arguments. For example, he argues that rhyme in metrical verse is identical to the way songwriters like Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn and Lorenz Hart and Richard Rodgers constructed their iconic melodies. Furthermore, the form of these tunes that they produced can be found in classical compositions, including those of Mozart. So it's really all kinds of music that he looks at and finds repetition. And then he moves on to look at repetition in paintings, like Gustave Caillebotte's, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing the name correctly because it's French and I speak Spanish and English, Rainy Day in Paris, that painting. Uh-huh. And then in Andy Warhol's Campbell's Soup Cans and Jackson Pollock's Drip paintings. And then finally, he looks at photography, the photography of people like Ronnie Horne and Ormond Gigley, whose Girls in the Windows is one of the highest grossing photographs in history. All are shown to be built on repetition in the form of what he calls visual rhyme. Play It Again, Sam ends with a theory about why repetition has become so prominent in the arts and even why it's always been so prominent in the arts. He goes all the way back to Homer. According to Kaiser, the reason artists have exploited repetition throughout the ages is straightforward. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
It's because the brain finds repetition to be innately pleasurable. It's a neuroscience thing. Fascinating book.
Wow, that does sound interesting. So does he bring it up in terms of music? Does he come to current music or does he stop with these classic songwriters that you mentioned? Does he talk about rap music or any of that stuff?
He doesn't talk about rap. He doesn't talk about, like, super contemporary music. But he would talk about, like, Broadway show tunes and that kind of stuff, absolutely. Hmm. He's, I think, almost 90, somewhere around there. He's an older gentleman. So his references tend to be what the youngsters of today might call a bit dated. But I was able to follow them, and the few things I hadn't heard of, I Googled, and there they were. So it's a very readable book, although you have to pay attention. I mean, it's a smart book by a smart person for smarties, but I liked it.
And have you met him?
I have met him, not in person, but via Zoom. Uh-huh. And I felt dumb when I did because he was going on about Ormond Gigley's Girl in the Windows, which everybody knows, except at the time I had never seen it before. And he was extolling its virtues, and I was frantically Googling it, trying to find it while I was on the Zoom with him, and accidentally knocked him off the Zoom while I tried to find the photograph. That was a bit embarrassing, but a very, very nice man, and has been a legend at MIT for years. I should also mention, I'd be remiss not to, he got the blurb of all blurbs for this book from no other than Steven Pinker, who said it is a brilliant analysis of a major part of the pathos and pleasure in art, rhetoric, and music. Would that all authors could get a Steven Pinker blurb. I can't think of anything much better than that, but good for Samuel J. Kaiser. that he got one.
It sounds really interesting. Yeah, I know. I think isn't that why? That must be why, you know, advertisers use repetition over and over again. And
sure.
Yeah, I mean, it sticks in your memory.
Makes the brain happy.
I was in FAO Schwartz one time, you know, the famous toy store.
And, just one time, Gary?
Well, this particular time. And and they have this little FAO Schwartz theme that plays, you know, over and over again. It's this really, really, really horrible, you know, little, it makes It's a Small World seem like a symphony. And I went to the desk and I said to the woman behind the desk, I said, could I get a CD of this? And she said, don't worry, you don't need a CD of it. Now that you've heard it, it will play on and on in your head for the rest of your
forever
life.
Forever and ever. Yes. But now that I've mentioned repetition in the arts, you will not be able to not see it and not hear it.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. So look for it. You'll see it.
I will. And of course, Andy Warhol is such a great example of it, right? Because, you know, he made images over and over again with the one big piece of three Elvises or repeated Marilyn Monroe's with different colors or Elizabeth Taylor in different colors over and over again.
All of that stuff builds on repetition, and that is Samuel J. Kaiser's point. We like that because it repeats.
And even in church, not that I've ever spent time in church, but you know, the call and response involved in that kind of thing that happens in all places of worship, I believe.
Yeah, it definitely does in a temple, and it does in, you know, churches too.
Yeah.
So yeah, he could do a whole other chapter on the use of repetition in religion. I'll get him right on the case.
Yeah, oh, good. Samuel J. Kaiser, and the book is called "Play It Again, Sam: Repetition in the Arts."
You got it.
Lisa Warren, thank you for telling us about it. It's always good to talk to you.
You too.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.